the headlines. Iran says it is seriously following up the case of the U.S. assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani and will not let those behind it go unpunished. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases across the globe surpasses the grim milestone of 80.8 million. And the 27 EU member states give the green light for the post-Brexit trade deal to go into effect on January 1st. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iran says that it will not let those behind the assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani go unpunished. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said Iran is seriously following up the case of General Soleimani's killing through legal and diplomatic channels. Khatibzadeh underlined the role of the martyred general in fighting terrorism and establishing security and peace in the region. You see, that Soleimani was a pillar of regional balance who sacrificed his life in the fight against extremism. General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated back in January by the U.S. during a visit to Iraq. Iran's judiciary says 48 suspects have been identified in connection with the assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. The spokesman for the judiciary's Human Rights Council said necessary steps have been taken to bring the suspects to justice. Ali Baghdadi said the judiciary has asked countries believed to possess intelligence on the assassination to share evidence with Iran. He said one of those countries is Germany, explaining that a U.S. military base there was involved in an exchange of signal with American drones, which carried out the assassination. 1 year has passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and resistance icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondents have talked to a number of Syrian and Palestinian people about the assassination.
Qasem Soleimani sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and spent his life fighting for Palestine. His legacy will never die because thousands more Soleimanis will be born and a new knight will lead the way.
His memory will remain forever in the hearts of Palestinians and Iranians. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was especially harsh for all of us in Gaza who remain under siege. The absence of Qasem Soleimani has encouraged Arabs to normalize their relations with our enemy. His martyrdom was a great loss for Palestinians who will find it harder to liberate their land. Since his martyrdom, Israel has stepped up its aggression and siege against the Palestinians.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of devotion and sacrifice for Syrians. People. The services he did are unforgettable. He will remain in the memories of the coming generations in Syria. Words cannot describe his efforts and his sacrifices.
Qasem Soleimani.
May he rest in peace. He was a commander and a hero, a big hero, and a symbol of steadfastness and sacrifice for us, especially here in Syria. I congratulate him on his martyrdom. Not all people are worthy of such martyrdom. The U.S. did not achieve anything from his assassination, because one Qasem Soleimani is gone, but 10 other Qasem Soleimanis will come. He stood alongside Syrians from Aleppo to Damascus. My brothers fought under his directives. They were ordinary fighters, but they told me he used to dine and spend time with them. He was so down to earth.
Soleimani was not the first and will not be the last resistance figure. The path of resistance and the way of Imam Hussein will live forever until liberating the last inch of every occupied land. Soleimani was a fighter, a struggler. May he rest in peace. He stood beside us. There are hundreds of others like Soleimani.
The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases across the globe surpasses the grim milestone of 80.8 million. Now, data presented by the Johns Hopkins University shows the global death toll from the disease now stands at over 1.7 million. The U.S., India, and Brazil are still the worst-hit countries, with the U.S. reporting over 19 million infections and more than 300,000 deaths. Many countries are struggling with the new variant of the coronavirus, which was first detected in the U.K. The severity of the situation has prompted them to impose restrictions on freight and travel to and from Britain. Several members of the European Union started a vaccine rollout on Sunday in an attempt to rein in the highly contagious disease. Austria begins a nationwide COVID vaccination program prioritizing nursing homes, healthcare personnel, and frontline workers. Up to 10,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine entered the country on Saturday, and officials say that the country will receive over 4 million doses by the summer. Homolinski reports.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria.
an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first five volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included three elderly patients with underlying health conditions and two healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the two doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in three phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its third hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a third corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe. Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Leski, Vienna.
European Union member states have given the go-ahead for the provisional application of the post-Brexit trade deal with the United Kingdom. EU ambassadors unanimously gave the green light for the accord to go into effect on January 1st. The move is to avoid disruption of tariff-free trade between London and Brussels once the UK leaves the EU single market in the new year. The post-Brexit trade deal, which was agreed on Christmas Eve, must still be ratified by the European Parliament. British lawmakers are also set to vote on the deal on Wednesday. The UK formally left the EU in January, but its transition period will complete on December 31. Trade rules between the two sides will remain unchanged until then. Bangladesh has begun moving a second group of Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite objections from rights groups. Nearly 1,000 Rohingya refugees are in the second batch to be sent to Bashanchar. The Bangladeshi Foreign Minister, Abdul Momen, claimed that Rohingya refugees are voluntarily going to what he called a beautiful resort. Dhaka wants to gradually relocate 100,000 Rohingya to the island from overcrowded camps that host about 1 million Muslim refugees from Myanmar. But rights groups say the refugees are being coerced and intimidated to move to the isolated territory. Rohingya Muslims were forced to take refuge in Bangladesh after a brutal army crackdown in neighboring Myanmar. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned suspicious moves by Israel aimed at building a military base on the island of Socotra. This after Israeli media revealed the arrival of an Israeli submarine in the Bab el-Mandab Strait. They called it a threatening message to the Yemeni army, which has become a stumbling block to Israeli interests in the Red Sea. Abdulatif Al-Washali has the details.
The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab el-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemen territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region that, despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has called for the quote early release of Saudi women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathloul hours after she was sentenced to almost 6 years in jail. In a tweet, the office slammed the conviction of Hathloul as deeply troubling. She's been accused by the government of terrorism-related crimes and harming national security. The prominent women's rights campaigner has been in custody since May 2018, when she was arrested along with at least a dozen other activists. Saudi Arabia is facing growing international criticism for its human rights violations, but the kingdom has been pushing ahead with its clampdown on dissidents. Iran has hosted the 6th Arbaeen International Awards. The annual event honors the best cultural products that are themed with Muslims' love for Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The 6th Arbaeen International Awards was held in Tehran. It honors the best films, photos, and travelogues that offer the best narrative of the Arbaeen tradition. Arbaeen is the story of millions of people who beat long distances on foot to get to the shrine of the third Shia Imam Hussein in Iran. 40 days after his martyrdom anniversary, some 5,000 works from 21 countries competed in this year's edition.
By holding this festival, we sought to bring to light the beautiful Islamic culture through the language of art. Sometimes words cannot relay the messages. Here's when the art, as a universal language, can translate our beliefs to other communities.
This year, the Arbaeen Award is themed with Generals of Resistance, Protectors of Security of Arbaeen. This is to honor late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq back in January. Soleimani is respected by the Iraqi nation as their savior for his role in dismantling Daesh terrorists in the Arab country.
The Iraqi nation and the whole region appreciates what General Soleimani did for them. Without him, the terrorists would have continued to be at large, serving the U.S.'s interests in our land. As a filmmaker, I feel bound to shed light on the great role that Soleimani played for our security.
Qasem Soleimani is now a world-renowned figure. Today, freedom seekers around the world, including our people in Guinea-Bissau, know Mr. Soleimani as a person who sacrificed his life in the path of resistance against the terrorists and their American supporters.
Hosted and organized by Iran's Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, the Arbaeen Award was launched in 2014 with the aim of introducing the Arbaeen tradition and the character of Imam Hussein to international audience.
The main goal of the International Arbaeen Award is to honor those who convey the messages of the Muslim world through the language of art. This, the organizers say, will help preserve the legacy of icons like General Soleimani, whose role as the nemesis of terrorists is now reflected through thousands of artworks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In a bid to diversify its economy and move away from independence on oil, the United Arab Emirates is trying to establish itself as a regional gold trade hub. It appears, however, that the country would go to any lengths to make the ambitious plan work.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months,
particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from?
Well, when it comes to the United Arab Emirates, gold actually makes up a majority of its imports. Based on the latest figures that we have, it's over $17.7 billion that it was registered for the year 2019 in terms of what it registered for the sales, and that surpassed actually the country's oil sales. So you can see that that is something indeed which has brought in a lot of money for the UAE's economy. But where does this come from? That is the whole point of the topic for this ONL in terms of where the oil is, where the gold is coming from. They call it blood gold because of where and how it is extracted and the way that it's made it, which according to the way that some organizations like the FATF have said, the UAE then becomes suspected to a center for money laundering because many drug traffickers are actually doing this through the UAE.
According to investigations conducted by the Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do. But they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports. Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
The failure to meaningfully decarcerate jails and prisons in the U.S. has led to increased cases in the community, as the staff travel between work and their home communities on a daily basis. Between California, Florida, and Texas, mass incarceration contributed to a 250,000 new COVID cases, or 20% of new cases in these states from May 1st to August 1st. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Victoria Law Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. states say they are decarcerating, yet one in five prisoners has had COVID. Here's the details of this article. On December 10th, nearly 9 months after the coronavirus exploded across the United States of America, prisons reported 276,235 confirmed COVID cases, a rate more than four times as high as that among the general public. One in five prisoners has had COVID-19. Prisons have had at least 1,738 deaths from COVID. And the impacts of incarceration-related COVID outbreaks extend beyond the jail walls. Guards and others traveling in and out of prisons have contributed to community spread. A new report by the Prison Policy Initiative estimated that in the summer alone, prisons and jails contributed to more than 500,000, or roughly 13% of additional COVID-19 cases nationwide. From the start of the pandemic, public health and medical officials warned that incarcerated people were uniquely vulnerable to COVID and its most severe complications. Many people enter prison with a raft of pre-existing health conditions. Inside the prison, they are unable to physically distance from each other or adhere to other Center for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines, such as frequent hand washing, using alcohol-based sanitizers, or wearing masks. Many prisons did not issue masks for weeks, forcing incarcerated people to risk sanctions when they improvised masks from other pieces of clothing. Experts' predictions quickly came true as several jails and prisons emerged as the nation's top hotspots. Meanwhile, some states such as Indiana have resisted implementing early release policies. Furthermore, population reductions have not been enough to stem the spread. California's prisons remain at 105% capacity. Of its 92,170 prisoners, 5,343 have active COVID cases and 93 have died. New York's prisons reported 120 new cases in early December, bringing its total to 1,959 cases among its 35,353 state prisoners. In Michigan, the numbers are even more stunning. With the help of the state's National Guard, the Department of Corrections tested all 34,000 remaining prisoners. As of December 17th, 19,710 have tested positive, with 6,727 active cases, and 104 have died, a dramatic increase from 3,944 cases and 68 deaths in June. Even more alarming, 115 people who had previously tested positive for COVID have tested positive for a second time. At its Gus Harrison Correctional Facility, over 72%, or 1,423 of the 1,455 incarcerated men tested positive, six have died. As the pandemic drags on and the threat of COVID transmission becomes a normalized reality, incarceration reductions are reversing. From March to July, the majority of 514 jails surveyed by the Prison Policy Initiative had reduced the number of people behind bars by an average of 26%. Since July, however, 77% of these same jails saw increases in their populations, a trend, says Prison Policy Initiative, suggesting that the early reforms instituted to mitigate COVID-19 have largely been abandoned. Some, such as the jails in Cook County, Illinois, and Jefferson, Louisiana, have managed to slightly surpass their pre-pandemic February populations. Others have seen dramatic increases. St. Lucie, Florida, for example, jailed 808 people in February. Throughout the pandemic, it has steadily increased its jail population to 1,332 people as of December 4th. State prison populations are also beginning to climb again. North Dakota's prison population, which decreased by 19% between January and May 2020, is starting to inch up. From October 8 to November 19, the state increased its prison population by 3%. By Halloween, its prisons saw a surge in COVID. 66 of its 600 incarcerated people, as well as 21 of approximately 200 staff members, tested positive. Prison intakes, previously halted in many states to prevent COVID exposure, have restarted. Each new arrival brings the potential for COVID to enter and explode throughout the prison. New arrivals are supposed to undergo 14 days of quarantine before mixing with the general population. But this is not always the case. In New York, for instance, when prison officials first converted Adirondack Correctional Facility into a prison for men ages 65 and older, men reported not being tested or quarantined upon arrival. Quarantine also didn't stop COVID from exploding at Rockville, the Indiana prison where Sarah Jo Pender is incarcerated. Our rooms are fenced in cubicles with 14 to 16 women per room, she explained. We live in bunk beds separated by 3 feet. Every 136 women share 2 bathrooms. The U.S. failure to meaningfully decarcerate jails and prisons has also led to increased cases in the community as staff travel between work and their home communities on a daily basis. Between California, Florida, and Texas, mass incarceration contributed to a 250,000 new COVID-19 cases, or 20% of new cases in these states from May 1st to August 1st. Despite its much-touted release of 22,148 people from prisons, the Prison Policy Initiative estimated that California's incarceration alone contributed 113,969 COVID cases, or 291 cases per 100,000 residents. In Indiana, where Pender and many other women wear their masks to bed in a desperate bid to avoid COVID, the state's insistence on keeping people in prison led to 6,879 additional cases, or nearly 104 per 100,000 residents. In Park County, where Rockville is located, 28% of residents tested positive. 20% of Rockville staff also tested positive. In Michigan, mass incarceration led to an additional 4,787 COVID-19 cases, or 48 per 100,000 residents throughout the state. That was what prompted the residents of Adrian, Michigan, the town where the Gus Harrison prison is located, to join family members and advocates during their December 11 protest, demanding the release of aging and medically vulnerable people.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Signs of an Oppressor. When the ugly urge to oppress becomes ingrained and dominates one's mind, it shows up in different ways depending on the situation. If he cannot oppress overtly a strong opponent, the oppression takes subtle forms like disobedience. Against the weak, the oppressor resorts to open aggression, force, violence, and injustice. Another sign of an oppressor is that he selects his friends and companions from among the unjust. You know the phrase, birds of feather flock together. So for somebody who is oppressive in nature, that means he has developed an instinct and he has developed this trait of being oppressive towards others, this person cannot by any means ever hang out with the people who are justice seekers, those people who have developed the instinct of being just in their everyday lives, and they seek justice for others as well. These two are incompatible. So inevitably, this person who has somehow been affected and inflicted with this disease of being oppressive, this person is left with no choice but to hang out with people, but to be friends with people, but to be acquaintance with people who are unjust and oppressive. Now, this is serious because we've got too many traditions where we have been told what kind of company to keep, what kind of friends we are supposed to have in our lives, when it comes to, like, you know, building relationships, you know, marital relationships, looking for spouses. There are clear instructions in Islam. So this person who has now turned into an oppressive person, there is no way that this person would be comfortable near the people who are just in their behavior. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we're discussing the signs of an oppressor. And we said that nobody likes oppression, and the oppressors inevitably end up hanging out and be friends with oppressors. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, the oppressor has three signs. He oppresses those who are higher than him through position and disobedience. And he oppresses those who are inferior to him through violence and predominance. And he cooperates with other oppressors. So this is what the infallible Imam said. So how do you oppress based on, you know, your instinct that you have developed towards this oppression? Well, if we go off of the hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the oppression on superiors is done through, and I'm just going to give you one example to get you thinking, is by being oppressive towards your parents, not fulfilling the rights of your parents. Then oppression on inferiors, it means you are oppressing your children, your friends sometimes, you know, people, other people in the society who may not enjoy the same social status that you do. They do not have authority as you do. So you end up oppressing them. The third one is oppression through cooperation with oppressors. And this is if you look at the countries. How many countries are unaware of the fact that the United States of America is an oppressive regime? It is oppressing the entire world. It is bullying the entire world. But they end up being their partners in crime. Like, look at the Saudi regime. Because the United States of America wants to achieve certain objectives in this region, what this Saudi government ends up doing is that they do their dirty work. Now, this is how oppressors accompany each other. So, you know, again, going back to our discussion of signs of oppressors, we have to look at the examples that are available in the society around us, and this this point is very easily comprehensible. And what are we supposed to do in return of this oppression? Well, rest assured, we have to fight back. We have to fight back in every way possible for justice in the society to prevail. We cannot have oppressive societies. We cannot have oppressive governments. We cannot have oppressive individuals. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump's political messages started hurting the Republican senators in Georgia long before this Christmas season. Trump railed against early voting throughout the campaign to sow doubt about the election results and set the predicate for the claims of voter fraud and attempts to nullify the November election. Early voting, traditionally a strong suit for Republicans, provided Biden with the margins he needed around the country. In Georgia, Republican Senate candidate David Perdue fell just short of the 50% threshold to avoid a runoff in his re-election bid. In the other Georgia Senate contest, Republican candidate Kelly Loeffler came in second to Democrat Raphael Warnock in a race where no candidate hit the threshold. The combination of massive early voting by Democrats and lower numbers on the GOP side made the January 5th runoffs possible. Trump's reaction to the election results has also hit the Perdue and Loeffler hard. His bitter criticism of Georgia's Republican governor and Secretary of State for not helping him overturn the results has split the Republican Party in the state, setting off a circular firing squad within the Republican Party was an unexpected gift for the Democrats. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Joe Lockhart, a political analyst who was the White House press secretary from 1998 to 2000 in President Bill Clinton's administration, titled, "Trump is Destroying His Own Party on the Way Out the Door." This article has appeared on the front page of the CNN.com. Please stay tuned. This holiday season, Donald Trump has wreaked havoc on U.S. Congress, its so-called democracy, and its judicial system by pardoning political associates and convicted murderers. But Trump has saved a special kind of Grinch-like behavior for the two Republican Senate candidates in Georgia, who are headed for runoff elections in January, and for Senator Mitch McConnell, whose fate as majority leader depends on the Republican Party GOP winning at least one of those races. These three are only the latest to realize that the return on investment for loyalty to Donald Trump is exactly zero. McConnell, David Perdue, and Kelly Loeffler all stood on the Senate floor in February and acquitted Trump on charges that he abused his power in office and obstructed Congress. But now that it's time for Trump to return the favor, U.S. self-absorbed president seems to be doing everything he can to make it harder for all three, and perhaps giving the Democrats the gift of control of the Senate as he leaves office. Trump's political messages started hurting the Republican senators in Georgia long before this Christmas season. Trump railed against early voting throughout the campaign to sow doubt about the election results and set the predicate for the claims of voter fraud and attempts to nullify the November election. Early voting, traditionally a strong suit for Republicans, provided Biden with the margins he needed around the country. In Georgia, Perdue fell just short of the 50% threshold to avoid a runoff
in his re-election bid. In the other Georgia Senate contest, Loeffler came in second to Democrat Raphael Warnock in a race where no candidate hit the threshold. The combination of massive early voting by Democrats and lower numbers on the GOP side made the January 5th runoffs possible. Trump's reaction to the election results has also hit Perdue and Loeffler hard. His bitter criticism of Georgia's Republican governor and Secretary of State for not helping him overturn the results has split the Republican Party in the state. Setting off a circular firing squad within the Republican Party was an unexpected gift for the Democrats. And it's a gift that keeps on giving. Trump's claims about the voter fraud and his refusal to accept the results of the election present a clear messaging challenge for the GOP. Under more normal circumstances, a lame duck president would make a strong case for winning the races to help keep his party's control of the Senate. But Trump can't be full-throated with this message and lay out the stakes while contending against all evidence that he will have a second term. Republicans don't need to win either race if Vice President Pence will still be there for the next 4 years to break a tie in the Senate. Making it worse for the state Republican Party, lawyers who are supportive of Trump, led by Lynn Wood, have cast doubt on Georgia being able to conduct a fair election. They've told Trump supporters to stay home and not vote in the January runoff. Clearly, in such a close race, neither side can afford any significant boycott on voting. After McConnell finally acknowledged that Joe Biden was president-elect following the Electoral College vote, Trump had an aide send a memo to Republicans in Congress trashing the majority leader. It suggested that the reason McConnell won his re-election contest by nearly 20 points was because of the president's endorsement and that the majority leader wasn't sufficiently grateful. That sent a message to Trump supporters that maybe McConnell wasn't worth saving. Trump may have saved his biggest gift to the Democrats with his Christmas week torpedo launched at Congress. House and Senate leaders spent months painfully negotiating a COVID-19 relief bill, providing desperately needed aid to millions of Americans suffering through the pandemic. Democrats were pushing for a large stimulus check to be sent to Americans, while Republicans opposed any direct payments. The compromise at $600 was seen as a victory for the Republican senators, who held the line against a bigger number. Then, after all the votes were taken in Congress, Trump called the bill a disgrace and proposed a $2,000 check, a move that completely undermined the Republican messaging machine. Perdue and Loeffler now have to defend why they voted for the small payment, which the president now opposes. Voters are now likely to focus on the president being completely absent from the relief negotiations and only speaking out after the votes were cast. To make matters worse, the president also conflated the COVID-19 bill with the omnibus spending bill, which were attached to each other for the vote. The president derided multiple spending items like foreign aid and support for the arts, which in fact were taken from his own budget proposal, reminding conservative voters in Georgia that their senators voted for what Trump calls disgraceful spending. While the president may, in the end, sign the bill, he did no favor for his party's Senate candidates. The president is the leader of the Republican Party, and all signs suggest he will continue to be influential for some time after leaving the White House. But his actions recently should remind Republicans that Trump has no loyalty to the GOP. Time and again, Americans have learned with the president that it is only about Trump. And the parting gift of Trumpism, as Joe Biden is sworn in, may well be a Senate controlled by the Democrats.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
Another matter is about moral education. Of course, according to today's reports and the reports delivered to me from various places, good tasks have been carried out in our academies in terms of religious, ideological, and moral orientations, but I wish to focus on moral education above all. Our academies should pay more attention to this matter. We should polish our dear youth's inner selves. The youth gathering together here are my dear children. They are the pure souls of our society. They are among our best people in our society. Therefore, we should provide the means to polish them as much as we can. Their spiritual deployment lies in piety, sincerity, courage, humility, and commitment to one's pledge and promise to the system, to Islam, and to the revolution. This constitutes their spiritual deployment, and they are the most important elements in this regard.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, this is not particular to the youth in the armed forces. All young forces of the country, and most importantly, the working on the path, the revolutionary forces of the country, the forces which consider themselves to be working on the path of the revolution, religiousness and piety, as this is really the case, should pay attention to these commitments. It should not be the case that if a youth of ours undertakes the responsibility, he should try to pin his hopes on an important position and on gaining money and trifles. Youth should work in a sincere manner, as they did during the sacred defense era. Those who made sacrifices during the sacred defense era managed to make achievements with purity and spirit of self-sacrifice. And this has been the case ever since. Running after worldly trifles disrupts one's work. If there are some individuals who do tasks with the purpose of achieving worldly goals, gaining financial rewards, and winning worldly positions, then our affairs will not move forward. It is with endeavor and purity that affairs will move forward.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.